Osho Talk. Zen, The Path of Paradox, Volume 1, Number 4.
The first question. Norman O'Brown has said, the next generation needs to be told that the real fight is not the political fight, but to put an end to politics. From politics to metapolitics, from politics to poetry. In what way is poetry revolutionary? Poetry is not revolutionary, poetry is revolution. Because poetry is a totally different vision of life. Poetry is a metamorphosis, a metanoia. Poetry means looking at life with wonder, looking at life as mystery, looking at life to celebrate it. Poetry is not just poetry, it is approaching existence with love. Science is a rape, because reason basically is a rape. Poetry is a love affair. Reason is aggressive. Reason is violent. Poetry is non-violent. Reason thinks, poetry feels. We have built a world around thinking, and it has failed. It has failed utterly. In the world of prose, in the world of logic and reason, the politician becomes very, very important. In the world of feeling, in the world of poetry, in the world of love, the mystic will replace the politician. Reason is ambitious. It wants to capture power. Why it wants to capture power? Why it wants to possess power? Because deep down it feels important. A great inferiority complex exists just at the bottom. To cover it, reason tries to become powerful. Whatsoever is needed to do, good or bad, reason is ready to do it. But the power is needed at any cost. Without power, one feels deep down a nobody. One feels a non-entity. Reason is the ego trip. Let prose be the symbol for reason. Poetry is a symbol for feeling. It is so powerful in itself, it needs no other power as a substitute. It suffers from no inferiority complex. A man of feeling is non-ambitious. He loves tremendously, but he is not a hoarder. He has a being, but he is not in search of having more and more and more. He is non-competitive. Because he is not ambitious, how he can be competitive? When he is non-ambitious and non-competitive, he befriends existence. That's what Buddha calls compassion. Yes, poetry is revolution. But I don't know whether Norman or Brown exactly knows what poetry is. He himself is a logician. I don't know whether he has ever experienced poetry. When he talks about poetry, that too is talking about it. You can talk about poetry, but what you talk remains prose. One has to be a poetry. One has to be a mystic. Talking about mysticism is not going to help. It is the same thing. Nothing has changed. It is the same disease with a new label. Maybe the bottle is new, but the wine is old. That's why he misses. Look again at his statement. The next generation needs to be told. The language of telling the next generation is the language of the politician. The next generation needs not to be told. The next generation needs to be sown. One should become a mystic. That's the only statement possible. Not that the next generation has to be told. Then you become a leader. Then you are no more a master. What is the difference between a leader and a master? A leader tells you what to do. A master is. He shows you how to be. Brown says the next generation needs to be told that the real fight is not the political fight, but it still remains a fight. The language is still of aggression. The language is still of rape, not of love. These things so. These are the loopholes. One has to read between the lines. Only then you understand. Fight again. The very word fight is ugly. And he says, the real fight is not the political fight. But any fight is going to be political. Fight as such is politics. Against what you fight makes no difference. You will become a politician. The mystic fights not. The mystic is a dropout. Remember it. He is not a fighter. He is exactly a dropout. Seeing the absurdity of things, he gets out of this. He jumps out of the wheel. If you fight, you remain in it. You become part of it. Even in opposition, you remain in it. Just by being opposite to anything, you don't go beyond. Being opposite, you are not transformed. Then you will have a politics of an anti-politician. But that is nothing. And remember, when two persons fight, they become alike. People are more like their enemies than like their friends. Have you not observed it? Because when you have to fight with somebody, you have to choose the same strategy, the same techniques, the same weapons, the same ways. Churchill fighting with Hitler becomes almost a Hitler. It has to happen. Otherwise, you will not win over Hitler. Churchill wins over Hitler because he proves to be more of a Hitler than Hitler himself. The enemy transforms you utterly like himself. That's why I say, you can choose your friends foolishly, but never choose your enemies unwisely. Friends don't transform you so much. But enemies go deep. Enmity goes deep. Love seems to be very, very momentary. Hate seems to be very permanent. Love affair happens and goes. The honeymoon ends very soon. But enmity continues for years, for generations, sometimes for centuries. Why? Man is capable of more hatred than of love. In fact, sometimes when you see him in love, it is only because of hatred. For example, if India and Pakistan go to war, there is great love amongst Indians. They feel more united. They feel more like a family. Then the Maharashtrian is not in fight with the Gujarati. Then the Hindi-speaking people are not against the non-Hindi-speaking people. Then they forget all their enmity. They are one. The common enemy creates a kind of love. It is love created out of hatred. When that hatred is no more there, this love will disappear. It was a byproduct. Joseph Stalin and Winston Churchill and Roosevelt became friends. They were enemies. They became friends because of the common enemy, the Hitler. Once Germany is gone, their friendship is also gone. That friendship was not a friendship. It was a political affair born out of the common enemy. Remember, love that is born out of enmity is not love. It is a false coin. And all political unity depends on it. You are not united with somebody, you are united against somebody. That's the logic of politics. Now you tell people that the real fight is going to be against politics. You will make them political. They will start fighting politicians. They will start fighting politics, but they will become political. Meanwhile, they will slowly learn the same technology, the same strategy, the same ways. By the time they win, they will be as political as the people they were fighting against. This has happened so many times in the world that it looks simply stupid that we are not yet aware of it. What happened in the Russian Revolution? The communists were fighting against the Tsar, one of the most despotic rulers ever. Fighting with Tsar, they became Tsars. When they came in power, they proved to be more dangerous, more despotic, more dictatorial than Tsar himself. Now one Joseph Stalin is enough for 1,000 Tsars. He killed millions of people and killed in the name of revolution. And those people were not rich people. They were poor people. Proletarians. proletarians are being killed for the sake of proletarians, but the violence continues. What happened? What is the mechanism? Why Joseph Stalin turns anti-revolutionary? One of the greatest revolutionaries, how he turned into anti-revolutionary? If you fight with a czar, you will have to become like a czar. By and by you will learn the same language. By the time you come into power, another czar comes into power. The czar changes, but the czardom continues. That's how it has happened always. Just a slight intelligence is enough to show it to you. The revolution has always failed because the revolutionary has turned into anti-revolutionary when he comes to power. He has to turn. He cannot do anything else. The next generation needs to be told that the real fight is not the political fight. The real fight is not a fight at all. The real fight cannot be a fight at all. One has to drop out. The real revolutionary is not fighting anybody. He simply sees the absurdity of things, drops out. He says, I'm not going to be a part of it. This way or that, neither for nor against. It is so stupid that I cannot be even against it. Very few people are real revolutionaries. A Buddha is a real revolutionary. A Bodhidharma is a real revolutionary. The Zen mystics I have been talking about are real revolutionaries. But they have been not thought about as revolutionaries. They are thought to be escapists. Even Brown will think that they are escapists. They should give a good fight to the politician. Then they are revolutionaries. But if you give a good fight to the politician, you become a politician. Yes, one politician is defeated, another politician comes in power. And naturally, the one who comes in power is more powerful than the one who has been defeated. Power goes on moving into more cunning and more dangerous hands. What I say, the real fight is not a fight at all. Very courageous people are needed to become dropouts. If many, many people become dropouts, the world will change. There is no other way. I am all for dropouts. Enough of revolution and enough of revolutionaries. It simply goes on giving hope. It is just a carrot dangling in front of you. You can never eat it. It goes on moving. It is like a receding horizon. You go on rushing towards it, it goes on receding back. But the distance remains the same. Says Brown, from politics to metapolitics, but it still remains politics. He calls it metapolitics. Just by changing names, nothing has changed. If you ask me, I will say from politics, no politics, not metapolitics. From politics to no politics. Only then you move from politics to poetry. Poetry is a benediction. Poetry is not in any way concerned with any structure, social, political, economical. Poetry is concerned with existence. Poetry is concerned with clarity of vision. Poetry is concerned with a meditative state of consciousness. For poetry, you have to become meditative. You have to become more celebrating. You have to learn more dancing, more singing. You have to learn the language of joy. You have to become more sensitive. You have to become more alive in your senses. Your eyes should see more, and your ears should hear more, and your hands should touch more. You should again become a little more wild. You should learn again from the peacocks how they dance, and you should learn again from the birds how they go on madly singing, and you should learn from the mountains and the rivers and the sands. To be poetic, one needs to be natural. Politics is artificial. Poetry is falling back into nature, is losing yourself back into nature. Poetry is dissolving your being into something bigger than you. Yes, poetry is revolution. And that's what I am teaching you here. Be poets. And I don't mean that become a Shakespeare or a Kalidas or a Rabindranath. No, I don't mean that. When I say be poets, I mean become a Buddha. Because whatsoever you call poetry, and whomsoever you call poets, they are just glimpses of the great poetry I am talking about. Just glimpses, fragments. What a Rabindranath comes to see is just a glimpse. It is far away, like the Himalayan peaks. Far away, thousands of miles far away. But the poet has a glimpse of it. Buddha lives there on those peaks. Rabindranath creates a poetry. Buddha is a poet. The difference is tremendous. Buddha may not create poetry. Who bothers when you are a poet? Rabindranath creates a poetry. It is so beautiful. Those moments are so luminous that when he comes back to the earth, they linger a nostalgia, a sweet memory, a fragrance, and he wants to put it into words lest he forgets. Those moments are rare, once in a while. Otherwise the poet is as ordinary as you are. Otherwise the poet is as political as you are. Those moments are far and few in between. Only rarely he is transported in a vision. Buddha lives there. Bodhidharma abides there. For Rabindranath, poetry is an activity. For Buddha, it is life itself. Rabindranath writes poetry, Buddha breathes it. So when I say become poets, I mean become Buddhas. Start living in a totally different kind of landscape. Listen more to the heart. Listen less to the head. It is in the head that is Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler is created. A Buddha is sitting there in your heart, in the innermost recesses of your heart. Go there. Move silently inwards. If many, many people are poets like Buddhas, the world would have been changed. but not by any direct efforts, by no direct action. Direct action is political. Indirect action is poetry. You don't do it directly. It simply starts happening. Because you have changed, you create a vibe of change. Because you live on a different plane, those who come in contact with you, they start hearing that sound of a different plane. They start hearing the song of the different worlds. They start becoming diffused with it. They start carrying your fragrance. One poet, like a Buddha or a Bodhidharma, creates thousands of poets in the world. He becomes catalytic. His presence inspires. That's why in the East we have praised satsanga. Satsanga means to be in the presence of a poet, to be in the presence of a master, to be with a master who has arrived. Just to be with him, that's all. When you pass through a garden, you may not even have touched the flowers. When you come back home, suddenly you feel the fragrance lingering with your clothes. When you come to a master, something starts lingering. Something starts hanging around you. In the beginning, it is very hazy. In the beginning, you cannot be certain what it is, what it is not. But one thing is certain, something is there. By and by, it starts becoming more and more clear. By and by, clarity arises, more transparency. And soon you find yourself settling in a totally different dimension of being. The second question, I cannot understand this phenomenon of your speaking. And you say you have not uttered a single word even. How is it possible? A Zen poem. The shadow of the bamboo sweeps the stair all night long, yet not a mote of dust is stirred. The moonbeams penetrate to the bottom of the pool, yet in the water not a trace is left. The third question. What is enlightenment? Enlightenment is finding that there is nothing to find. Enlightenment is to come to know that there is nowhere to go. Enlightenment is the understanding that this is all. That this is perfect. That this is it. Enlightenment is not an achievement. It is an understanding that there is nothing to achieve. Nowhere to go. You are already there. You have never been away. You cannot be away from there. God has never been missed. Maybe you have forgotten. That's all. Maybe you have fallen asleep. That's all. Maybe you have got lost into many, many dreams. That's all. But you are there. God is your very being. So first thing, don't think about enlightenment as a goal. It is not. It is not a goal. It is not something that you can desire. And if you desire it, you will not get it. Desiring thousand and one things, by and by you come to understand that all desiring is futile. Each desire lends you into frustration. Each desire again and again throws you into a ditch. And this has been happening for millions of years. Again you start hoping. Again you think, maybe this new desire that is arising, is sprouting in me, maybe this will lead me to paradise. This will give me the longed for. This will fulfill me. Again hope arises. Enlightenment is when all hope disappears. Enlightenment is disappearance of hope. Don't be disturbed if I say enlightenment is a state of hopelessness. But it is not negative. Hope arises no more. Desire is created no more. Future disappears. Because when there is no desire, there is no need for the future. The canvas of future is needed for the desire. You paint your desires on the canvas of future. When there is nothing to paint, why you should carry the canvas unnecessarily? You drop it. When there is nothing to paint, why you should carry the brush and the color tubes? They come from the past. Canvas comes from the future, and colors and brush and the technique and all that comes from the past. When you are not going to paint, you throw the canvas, you throw the brush, you throw the color tubes, then suddenly you are here now. This is what the other day I was talking about. Chitta chana. This is what Buddha calls chitta chana. A moment of awareness. A moment of consciousness. This moment of consciousness can happen any moment. There is no special time for it. There is no special posture for it. There is no special place for it. It can happen in all kinds of situations. It has happened in all kinds of situations. All that is needed is that for a single moment there should be no thought, no desire, no hope. In that single moment, the lightning. One day, Chikan Zinzi was mowing down the weeds around a ruined temple. When he threw away a bit of broken tile, it clattered against a bamboo tree. All of a sudden, he was enlightened. Whereat he sang, upon the clatter of a broken tile, all I had learned was at once forgotten. Amending my nature is needless. Pursuing the task of everyday life, I walk along the ancient path. I am not disheartened in the mindless void. Wheresoever I go, I leave no footprint. For I am not within color or sound. Enlightened once everywhere have said, such as this is the attainment. This poor monk, Chikan Zenzi, has been working for at least 30 years. Hard seeker he was. A very, very honest and sincere and serious seeker he was. He practiced all that was told to him. He visited many masters. He lived in many monasteries. He did all that humanly is possible. He practiced yoga. He practiced zazen. He did this and that. And to no avail. And nothing was happening. In fact, his frustration was growing more and more. The more methods were failing, he was becoming more and more frustrated. He had read all the Buddhist scriptures. There are thousands. It is said about this Chikan Zenzi that he had all the scriptures in his room. And he was constantly reading day and night. And his memory was so perfect, he could recite whole scriptures. But still nothing happened. Then one day he burnt his whole library. Seeing those scriptures in the fire, he laughed. He left the monastery. He left his guru. He went to live in a ruined temple. He forgot all about meditation. He forgot all about yoga. He forgot all about practicing this and that. He forgot all about virtue, sila. He forgot all about discipline. And he never went inside the temple to worship the Buddha. But he was living in that ruined temple when it happened. He was mowing down the weeds around the temple. Not a very religious thing to do. Not anything specific, not anything special. Just taking the weeds out. When he threw away a bit of broken tile, it clattered against a bamboo tree. And in that moment, chitta chana, the moment of awareness, that very clattering of the tile against the bamboo, and a shock, and a jerk, and his mind stopped for a moment. In that very moment he became enlightened. How one can become enlightened in one single moment? Yes, one can become because one is enlightened. Just one has to recognize the fact. It is not something that happens from the outside. It is something that arises inside that has been there. Just you were so clouded. You were so much full of thoughts. Now he has burned all the scriptures. That was symbolic. Now he no more remembers anything. Now he has forgotten all search. Now he no more cares. Unconcerned. He lives a very ordinary life. He is no more a monk either. He has no more any pretensions. He has no more any ego goals. Remember, there are two kinds of ego goals. One, the worldly, and the other worldly. Few people are searching for money. Few people are searching for power, prestige, pull. Few people are searching for God, moksha, nirvana, enlightenment. But the search continues. And who is searching? The same ego. The moment you drop the search, you drop the ego also. The moment there is no seeking, the seeker cannot exist. Just visualize this poor monk, who is no more a monk, living in a ruined temple, nowhere else to go, just clearing the ground, maybe to put some seeds there for vegetables or something. Comes across a tile, throws it. Is taken unawares. The tile clatters with a bamboo tree. The sudden clattering, the sudden sounds, and he becomes enlightened. And he says, upon the clatter of a broken tile, all I had learned was at once forgotten. Enlightenment is a process of unlearning. It is utter ignorance. But the ignorance is very luminous, and your knowledge is very dull. Your knowledge is very dark and dead, and that ignorance is very alive and luminous. He says, all I had learnt was at once forgotten. In that moment, I knew nothing. In that moment, there was no knower. In that moment, there was no observer. Just the sounds. And one is awakened from the long sleep. And he says, amending my nature is needless. That day he felt that I was just struggling unnecessarily. Amending my nature is needless. You need not amend you. You need not improve you. That is all just tommy rot. All those who go on saying to you, improve yourself, become this, become that, become virtuous. This is wrong, don't do it. This is good, do it. This will lead you to heaven and this will lead you to hell, beware. Those who go on telling you, amend your nature, improve upon yourself, are very dangerous people. They are one of the basic causes why you are not enlightened. The nature cannot be amended. It has to be accepted. There is no way to be otherwise. Whosoever you are, whatsoever you are, that's how you are, that's what you are. A great acceptance. Buddha calls it tathata. A great acceptance. Nothing is there to be changed. And how you can change it? And who is going to change it? It is your nature and you will be trying to change it. It will be just like a dog chasing its own tail. The dog will go crazy. But dogs are not so foolish. Man is. Man goes on chasing its own tail. And the more he finds it is difficult, the more he jumps, the more he tries, and becomes more and more bizarre. Nothing has to be changed because all is beautiful. That's enlightenment. All is as it should be. Everything is perfect. This is the most perfect world. This moment lacks nothing. This experience is what enlightenment is. Fifth question. You said, it is just before your eyes. Is it really that far away? Not really. I said only to persuade you. I have heard Mullah Nasruddin was talking to his son. And he was telling him again. He has told the story many times. And he was telling him again that when he went to South Africa, he killed 10 lions there. And the boy said, Papa, but just the last year you were saying lions were only 5. And now you have changed. Now you say 10. And Mullah Nasruddin, yes, I know. I had told you the last year that there were 5. Because you were not grown up enough to believe. Next year I will tell you 15. Because I say only that much which you can believe. Yes, I told you, it is just before your eyes. But this is only because to say more than that will be very difficult for you to believe. In fact, it is not in front of your eyes, it is behind your eyes. In fact, you cannot see it because it is the seer. God cannot be seen. God is the seer in you. God is one who is seeing through you. How can you see God? It is not in front of your eyes, it is just behind your eyes. But that will be too difficult right now. So I go slowly, I persuade you. I say it is just in front of your eyes. No, it is not even that far away. There is no distance between you and Him. Tattvamasi, that art thou. The sixth question, why Zen is paradoxical? Because life is. And Zen is a simple mirror reflection of life. Zen is not a philosophy. Philosophies are never paradoxical. Philosophies are very logical. Because philosophies are mind constructs. Man makes them. They are manufactured by man. They are man-made. Tailored. Logically arranged. Comfortably arranged so that you can believe in them. All those parts which go against have been dropped, rooted out, thrown away. They don't reflect life as such. They are chosen from life. They are not raw. They are cultures, constructs. Zen is paradoxical because Zen is not a philosophy. Zen is not concerned what life is. Zen is concerned whatsoever it is, it should be reflected as it is. One should not choose. Because the moment you choose, it becomes untrue. Choice brings untruth. Don't choose, remain choiceless and you remain true. But that's what we do. You fall in love with a woman and you start choosing. Soon you will be in trouble. You don't see the woman as she is. You only see that which is good and you just overlook all that is not good. There are thousand and one things. Few are good, few are bad. That's how people are made. God never makes goody-goodies. They will be very dull, dead. They won't have any backbone. They will be bloodless. He makes alive people. And each person has something that you like and something that you don't like. Because He has not been tailored especially for you. He has not been made for you. He has not come out of an assembly line in a factory. He is unique. He is Himself or she is herself. When you fall in love with a woman, you start choosing. You overlook many things. Yes, sometimes you feel she gets angry, but you overlook it. You don't take any note of it. You just see the goddess. You don't see the witch. The witch is there. No goddess can exist without a witch. Otherwise the goddess will not be worth. It will be too good to be enjoyed. It will be too good to be loved. And you don't want to worship a woman, you want to love a woman. You want a woman to be human, not a goddess. But that's what you do. You pretend. You don't look any negative factors. You start choosing. You create an image of the woman which is false, which is not true. sooner or later you will start feeling frustrated, because sooner or later the reality of the woman will go against the image that you have created. And then you start feeling as if you have been cheated, deceived, as if this woman has knowingly deceived you. Nobody has deceived you. You yourself are the writer of your whole drama. You have managed to deceive yourself because you started choosing. Had you seen the woman as she was, just like a mirror? Yes, there were beautiful things and there were ugly things too, because beauty never exists without ugliness. Ugliness never exists without beauty. They exist together. They are two aspects of the same coin. Yes, sometimes the woman was really sweet and sometimes was really bitter. If you had looked both the ways, then it would have been difficult, because then it was paradoxical. Then it won't fit with your Aristotelian logic. Then it seems illogical how a woman can be both. Yes, sometimes she loved you and sometimes she hated you. In fact, the deeper is her love, the deeper goes her hate too. Sometimes she was ready to die for you and sometimes she was ready to kill you too. A woman is a ferocious energy, just as a man is. But you make a fairy tale. You choose few parts and you draw few parts and you create an image. That image is not going to last. The honeymoon over and the reality will start asserting. Reality cannot be defeated by your imagination and by your dreaming. The reality has to be taken care of. Sooner or later, yes, you can postpone it for a time being, but not forever. And when the reality asserts, and it will assert in day-to-day life, when you meet a woman on the beach once a day, it is totally a different kind of animal. You are a different kind of animal too. Meeting for 1 hour, she is prepared for it. She is ready for it. She has rehearsed for it. She has been standing before the mirror for hours for it. Now you will not find the same woman if you start living with her 24 hours. It is impossible for her to be so much ready and rehearsed. By and by, she will start forgetting about you. She will get ready only when you are going to the movie. Otherwise, she will not bother. Then you will see something else which was never there before. Then small things of life, trivia, assert themselves. For small things, she starts arguing. You start arguing. For small things, there is anger and nagging and fighting. And these things you had never seen on the beach. On the beach you were seeing the full moon. On the beach the waves. On the beach the woman was not arguing with you. Whatsoever you were saying, she was saying yes. Whatsoever she was saying, you were saying yes. You were so ready to say yes that no was not possible at that moment. But the no cannot wait forever. It will come up. It will surface. The moment no surfaces, your image starts falling in fragments. Then you think the woman has done some wrong to you. And this example is not only about man and woman. This has been the whole story of philosophy. Each philosophy does it. Each philosophy chooses from reality few things and tries to remain oblivious of other things. And only because of this, each philosophy has loopholes. And each philosophy has leakages. And each philosophy can be criticized and has been criticized. Only those who believe in it, they may pretend they don't see the loopholes. But those who don't believe, they see only the loopholes. They choose from the other ends. Each philosophy has been criticized, and the criticism has not been wrong. It is as true. It is as true as the propounder's idea about it. It happens not only in philosophy, it has been happening in science too. We create a certain theory, and then the honeymoon with the theory. For a few years things go perfectly well, and then reality asserts. And reality brings few things, and our theory is in difficulty. Because we had excluded few facts. Those facts will protest. They will sabotage your theory. They will assert. In the 18th century, science was absolutely certain. Now it is no more. Now a new theory has come, the theory of uncertainty. Immanuel Kant, just 150 years before, came across this fact in Germany, and he said, reason is very limited. It sees only a certain part of reality, and it starts believing this is the whole. This has been the trouble. Sooner or later we discover more reality, and then that old whole is in conflict with the new vision. Immanuel Kant attempted to show that there were ineluctable limits to reason. Reason is very limited. But nobody seems to have heard. Nobody has cared about Immanuel Kant. Nobody cares about philosophers much. But science in this century has at last caught up with Kant. Now, Heisenberg in physics and Gödel in mathematics have shown ineluctable limits to human reason. They open up to us the glimpse of a nature irrational and paradoxical to the very core. Whatsoever we have been saying about nature has all gone wrong. All principles go wrong. Because nature is not synonymous with reason. Nature is bigger than reason. And Zen is not a philosophy. Zen is a mirror. It is a mirror. It is a reflection of that which is. As it is, Zen says the same. It does not bring any man-made philosophy into it. It has no choice. It does not aid, it does not delete. That's why Zen is paradoxical, because life is paradoxical. You just see and you will understand. You love a man and you hate the same man too. Now, our mind says this is not good, we should not do it. And we pretend also that we don't do it. But it is not possible. If you really want to drop hate part, you will have to drop love part too. But then both disappear and indifference arises. This paradoxicality is in the very nature itself. Day and night, summer and winter, God and devil are together. Zen says, when you say God is good, then problem arises. Then from where the bad comes, from where the evil comes. That's what religions have done, Christianity, Islam, Judaism. They have put separate God and devil. The evil comes from the devil, and all good comes from God. God means the good. But from where this devil comes? and then they are in trouble. And then finally they have to concede that God created the devil too. But then what is the point of going so roundabout? If devil is also created by God, then God remains the sole signature on existence. Then God remains the sole author. So whatsoever is happening through him, and he is paradoxical. That's what Zen says. God is paradoxical. As paradoxical as existence itself. God is nothing but another name for existence, for the totality of existence. Once you understand this paradoxicality, a great silence arises in you. Then there is no choice. Then there is no point. Then things are together. You cannot become a saint. Because if you want to become a saint, you will have to deny your devil. You will have to cut yourself in two parts. You will have to force your devil somewhere in your belly. And the devil will remain there and will go on sabotaging your sainthood. Zen brings great health to humanity. It says, you are both. Accept both. Don't deny. Don't choose. Accept both. In that acceptance there is a transcendence. In that very acceptance you are neither a saint nor a devil. And that's what a holy man is. Neither good nor bad. Are both. And when a person is both, knowingly both, those opposites cancel each other. Just try to understand it. This is one of the most fundamental keys. When you accept both the good and bad, and you don't choose, the bad and good cancel each other. The negative and the positive cancel each other. Suddenly there is silence. There is neither good nor bad. There is only existence with no judgment. Zen is non-judgmental. It is non-condemning. It is not non-evaluating. It gives you utter freedom to be. The sixth question. I am a fool. What should I do? What can you do? What anybody can do? Remain a fool. Become a perfect fool. Accept it. Why should you ask for doing something? What is wrong in being a fool? Relax with it. Enjoy it. Persist in it. There is a statement of William Blake. The fool who persists in his folly will become wise. So persist in it. Remain with it. Don't try to do anything else. Because if the fool tries something to do, it will be foolish. It will come out of your foolishness and you will do something wrong. It is better to keep quiet. That's why Zen people say, sit silently. Please don't do anything, because whatsoever you will be wrong. What can you do out of your foolishness? A fool trying to become wise, is it possible? How it is possible? The fool is trying to become wise. In his very wisdom, he will remain a fool. And you can find such fools all over the world. More so in India. Great scholars, great pundits. And if you look just a little deep, then just foolish people, wasting their life in useless scholarship. wasting their tremendous energy in logic chopping, in language, in grammar, in this and that. They smell of kerosene oil, reading late in the night. They don't smell of life. Life is not there. Bookish people have lost all track of the living waters of life. Great fools, but with a new foolishness added to it, that they think they are wise. No, I will not say that you should do anything. Don't do anything. You are a fool, so you are a fool. God wants you to be a fool. Enjoy it. Offer your foolishness to God. That's your gift to Him. What you can give Him back, whatsoever He gives, we can return Him back. Relax into it. A strange will look my advice, but that is the only way one day wisdom can arise. Yes, William Blake is right. The fool who persists in his folly will become wise. And why you should want to become somebody else? Why? This competition, this ambition brings ego in. This comparison is egoistic. Somebody is wise. I should become wise. Why? Let somebody be wise. That is his destiny. And what is wrong in being the way you are? There is variety. There is richness in life because of the variety. In the landscape of spring, there is neither better nor worse. The flowering branches grow naturally, some long, some short. That is the Zen standpoint. You look around, some trees are long, some trees are short. Some trees are trees and some trees are just bushes. But no competition anywhere. The Ashoka is not trying to become the cypress. The cypress is not worried about the Ashoka. The cypress does not feel inferiority because the Ashoka has such big leaves. And they both are not worried about the Gulmohar. And the Gulmohar is flowering. And there are so many flowers. Nobody is worried. Nobody is thinking of the other. Everybody is authentically into his own being. The Ashoka is the Ashoka. The cypress is the cypress. The Gulmohar is the Gulmohar. You be whatsoever you are, wherever you are, relax there. Let that be your meditation. And wisdom arises. Wisdom comes out of acceptance. Wisdom is not an acquirement. Wisdom is not knowledge. Wisdom is not information. Wisdom is this quality of tremendous acceptance, that you are happy, that you are contented. Just think of the beauty. A man happy and contented with even his foolishness. He has become wise. What more wisdom you need? A man contented with his foolishness. What more wisdom you need? And what more wisdom can do? Don't try to pull yourself by your shoestrings. Just be. The moment you start saying something that I want to be this and I want to be that, you are complaining. You are saying something against God. You are saying, why you have made me this way? You are saying to the whole This is not the way I would like to be. Why I am forced this way? Make me beautiful, make me strong, make me rich, make me wise, make me this, make me that. Zen people say, all these efforts are like the mosquito trying to bite into an iron bull. A mosquito trying to bite in an iron bull. It is not going to happen. But still I say, wisdom happens not through your efforts, but through your effortless acceptance. Not through you, but when you are no more there, it happens. Wisdom is not something that you can purchase. Wisdom is when you are not. Use foolishness as a situation to relax. If an ugly man relaxes and accepts his ugliness, a subtle beauty arises in him. The beauty of acceptance, the grace that comes naturally. And so is the case with the fool, and so is the case with all problems. After his enlightenment, a disciple slapped his master Obaku's face, remarking, "There is not, after all, very much in this enlightenment." And the master was so pleased, he danced, and the disciple has slapped him. And when Zen masters and Zen disciples slept, they slept real hard. And the master was so pleased, he danced. He danced because the disciple has arrived. There is nothing special in enlightenment. Just the acceptance of all that is. Just the utter relaxation into reality. Nothing much, nothing to brag about, nothing to say. The disciple is right. He says, there is not after all very much in this enlightenment. He has come home and now he understands he has been here always. This wisdom was always there, but he was missing it because he was seeking it. This light was always there, but he was so much worried about light that his vision has become very, very narrow and he could not see it. He has created his own misery. The bliss was always flowing, the juice was always flowing, and he was himself dying out of thirst unnecessarily. To be unenlightened is just unnecessary. To be enlightened is just natural. It is not an attainment. It is not an achievement. And then the master says to the disciple, Obaku says to his disciple, "Do you smell the mountain laurel?" "Yes, sir." "There," said the master, "I have held nothing back from you." It is so simple. Do you hear the birds singing? Do you see these green trees around? Yes, it is like that, so simple. And the master says, "Do you smell the mountain laurel?" "Yes, sir." And the master says, "There, I have held nothing back from you. So I have given you all that I can give. In fact, there is nothing to give. In fact, you have only to be awakened what you already have you have to be awakened to that. The seventh question: there is a new fourth force in psychology, transpersonal psychology, which seeks to explore the needs and aspirations that go beyond self-actualization and humanistic psychology. So says Asagoli. Are transpersonal psychology and your psychology of the Buddha synonymous? They cannot be. Transpersonal psychology still remains psychology. It still remains concerned with the objective. The psychology of the Buddhas is not really a psychology. Because a Buddha is born when the psychology disappears, when the mind disappears. And the psychology of the Buddhas is not objective. It is subjective. It is absolutely subjective. It can happen to you, but you cannot watch it happen in somebody else. There is no way. You can become a Buddha, but you cannot understand a Buddha. Even if Asagoli sits by the side of a Buddha for 1,000 years, he will not understand anything. Unless he becomes a Buddha. You cannot observe it. It is such an internal phenomenon. It is so deeply inside. It is the very inside of being. You cannot watch it from the outside. And all that you watch will again be nothing but a behavioristic standpoint. Yes, you can see the Buddha is silent. You can see he seems to be very graceful. You can see that he is less angry or not angry at all. You can see 1,001 things. But still you will not be seeing Buddhahood itself. When I talk about the psychology of the Buddhas, one thing to be remembered is, it is not really a psychology. I have to use words. No word is adequate for it. So I use some words, but always take them with a pinch of salt. It cannot be really called a psychology. Psychology presupposes a mind, and Buddha is a no mind. Psychology presupposes that the mind is functioning, thinking, planning, worrying, imagining, dreaming. And a Buddha has no dreaming, no planning, no worrying, no thinking. He simply exists. He exists like a rock, like a tree, like a river, just with one difference, a very tremendous difference, although the difference is that he exists without mind, but full of awareness. Now, this awareness cannot be understood from the outside. If you try to understand it, you will only misunderstand it. There is no way to check by instruments. There is no way. It will not come on any graph. All that can come on a graph remains of the mind. It is not of the beyond. The beyond is beyond grasp. One has to become a Buddha. One has to become the awakened soul. One has to come to this awareness himself. The psychology of the Buddhas is the yoga, the discipline, the inner journey, the science, or whatever you want to call it, to know that there is something inside you that can only be known through going there, through being there. No other way, no other approach is possible. Asagoli goes on talking about he's far better than Freud. At least he brings some vision of synthesis to psychology. Freud is analytical. Analysis is his method. Asagoli brings synthesis. But this synthesis is not what Buddhas talk about. This synthesis is a synthesis put together. Just think of a thing. I show you a rose flower. You take it apart. You want to know how it ticks. You take all petals apart. This is what Freud did with human minds. He took it apart. He wanted to label everything, classify, categorize. He wanted to pigeonhole everything. Of course, when you take everything apart, something disappears. Because something was there, the beauty of the rose flower, which exists only with the whole. When you take the flower apart, something mysteriously disappears. The flower disappears. Because the flower is not just the sum total of the parts. It is something more than the sum total of the parts. That more is what religion is. That more is what poetry is. And that more cannot be taken apart. Once you take the parts apart, something simply disappears, goes into non-existence, becomes unmanifest. Now what Asagoli has done, he has put that flower together again. That flower, which has been pulled apart by Freud, has been put together by Asagoli. He calls it psychosynthesis. But this flower is dead. It is not that unity which was before Freud analyzed it. Asagoli presupposes Freud. Without Freud there can be no Asagoli. Remember this. If Freud has not existed, there would have been no Asagoli. Freud does half the work and the other half is done by Asagoli. Freud dissects, Asagoli unites. But in the dissection, the primal unity has disappeared. Now you can put it together, but it will never be the same thing again. The flower cannot become alive again. Just by putting together, you can put it very cleverly, you can glue it together with the most improved glue, but invisible glue, but still, it will not be the same flower again. You will not be able to bring that beauty that has existed before analysis. That's why Zen says, go and have a look of your face that you had before you were born. The primordial unity. Go into yourself to that remote existence of your being when you were not put together. When you were a pure soul. Not even your mother and father has put this body together. You had not become embodied. Go there. Unembodied you were. Go there. Have a vision of that. Or go and have a look of your face when you will be dead and your body will be burnt. This original face is something that has not been analyzed. The psychology of the Buddhas is not a synthesis. It is a non-analysis. Let my emphasis be clear. Asagoli is synthesis. Freud is analysis. The psychology of the Buddhas is non-analysis. no deception. Otherwise, we go on changing arguments and we go on remaining in the same boat. It happens. The new inmate at the mental hospital announced in a loud voice that he was President Ford. This was particularly interesting because the institution already had a President Ford. The head psychiatrist decided to put the two men in the same room, feeling that the similarity of their delusions might prompt an adjustment that would help to cure them. They were introduced and then left alone. No disturbance was heard from the room that night. The next morning, the doctor had a talk with his new patient. "Doctor, I have been suffering from a delusion," said the new inmate. "I now know that I am not President Foch." "That's wonderful," said the doctor. "Yes," said the patient, "I am Mistress Ford." Now another illusion. From one illusion to another, it is not much of a change. Asagoli is not much of a revolution. Yes, he is creating an adjustment. But he remains a shadow to Freud. Freud looms large. Asagoli remains just a shadow to it. Without Freud, he will not know where to go and what to do. The psychology of the Buddhas is a totally radical standpoint. One has to go into one's own consciousness without dividing it, without analyzing it, without judging it, without evaluating it, without condemning it, without saying anything about it. Just go into it and have a feel of it, what exactly it is. The whole mind has to disappear, only then you become aware what it is. Because the mind goes on creating ripples on the surface and the mirror remains disturbed and the mirror goes on distorting. When the mirror disappears completely, the mind disappears completely and there is pure silence, kokoro, nothingness, satori, samadhi. That samadhi is the non-analytical state of your being. That is your primal state. That's what God is. But still, Asagoli comes closer to Buddha than Freud. Not very close though. A lady walked into a bar with a parrot on her shoulder. It kept saying, "Guess my weight, guess my weight." A fellow bar stooler asked the lady, "What was the meaning of that?" And she replied, "Guess my parrot's weight and you can go home and sleep with me." The man looked at the parrot and jokingly said, "£100. The lady grabbed him by the arm and said, "Come on, lover, that is close enough." That's how far close Asagoli is to the psychology of the Buddhas. And the last question. Why is Zen so much against the scriptures? I have learned so much from the Bible and I am ever so grateful to it. How these Zen people dare to say that the scriptures should be burned? Jesus, the Christian, has not gone yet. The Zen people are not against the scriptures, they are against your minds. And when they say burn the scriptures, they are saying burn your minds. The same people are not against the scriptures. Why they should be against poor scriptures? They are against knowledge, knowledgeability. They are against the constant hoarding of memory. They want you to be free of memory. They want you to be free of knowledge. They want you to come to a state of unlearning. Burning the scriptures is just symbolic. And Zen people are very down to earth. When they want to say a thing, they say it very loudly. Because they know how deaf you are. They shout. They don't whisper. Because they know even a shout is not going to be heard. This is just shouting. A Zen master burning the scriptures is just shouting to you that see what you have done with your knowledge and your scripture. And when they say burn the scriptures, they are saying how can you understand the scriptures? How you can understand the gospel without becoming a Jesus yourself? It is such a simple thing. A little intelligence, very little intelligence is needed to understand it. How can you understand the gospel? How can you understand the Sermon on the Mount without becoming a Jesus? It is impossible. And whatsoever you will understand will be a misunderstanding. And it is better not to understand than to carry a misunderstanding. Because that very misunderstanding will become a barrier to you. How can you read the gospel and you say, I have been benefited and I am so grateful to it? How you can be benefited? What you will understand when you will read a statement of Jesus, you will interpret it. A statement made by a higher consciousness is being interpreted by a lower consciousness. Is bound to be distorted. It is as if Einstein has been delivering a talk on higher mathematics. And you go to a primary school and you ask a child what he thinks about it. He will say something. But exactly that will be the case. Even far more distant will be the case. Because there is a possibility that a primary school student may understand a little bit of Albert Einstein's mathematics. Because the difference is quantitative. But it is impossible to understand a statement of Jesus or Buddha. Because the difference is qualitative. They are statements of a different dimension. Even in ordinary language, you go on understanding what you interpret. Listen to these few stories. The fifth grade teacher noticed that little Johnny seemed depressed and was not doing his homework. So she had him stay after his school. "What is wrong, Johnny?" she asked sympathetically. Finally, he blurted out, "I am in love with you," he said, "and I want to marry you." "Ah, Johnny," she smiled, "I want to get married someday, but I don't want a child." "That's okay," he said, "I will be careful." The second story, an Alabama Democrat had campaigned far and won a seat in the House of Representatives. In appreciation, he introduced a bill to build a bridge across Galahassas Creek back home. A Republican congressman became indignant. "There is no need for a bridge across that creek," he shouted. "That creek is so small, I could stand on one side of it and urinate halfway across." The Speaker of the House banged with his gavel and exclaim, "You are out of order. You are damned right. I am out of order," retorted the Republican. "If I was not, I would be able to urinate all the way across that damned creek." It depends on you. The third story. The cute and efficient young maid employed by the congressman and his wife seemed to enjoy her work until one day, without warning, she gave notice. "Why do you wish to leave?" the lady of the house asked her. "Is there anything wrong? I just can't stand the suspense in this house a minute more." The maid replied. "Suspense?" said the confused mistress. "What do you mean?" "It is the sign over my bed," the girl explained. "You know, the one that says, 'Watch ye, for ye know not when the master cometh.'" And the last. A traveling salesman decided to spend the night in a small town out west. After a few drinks at the hotel bar, he loosened up and began spouting his political opinions. "I tell you," he shouted, "President Ford is a horse ass." At this, a 6-foot cowboy stalked over to him and said, "Mister, them is fighting words around here." "I'm sorry, sir," stammered the salesman. "I did not realize that this was Ford country." "It aren't," growled the giant. "This here is horse country." Enough for today.